Hi, my darling listeners. How are you today? I hope you're doing fantastic because you are fantastic. I just wanted to give you a little reminder. Today's episode is another gem for my beauty founders, for my girls that are entrepreneurial, that want to create something, that want to start a brand. I had the pleasure of talking to Kim Von Hoster. She is the CEO and founder of Bloom Effects. Bloom Effects is a brand that is utilizing the power of tulips. Tulips have this ability to repair itself, and Kim noticed that. I actually love her story. So she, I mean, you're going to hear everything in the episode, but she was living and working in New York, you know, hustling in the corporate world, in the beauty space, and she fell in love with a Dutch man on a dance floor in Ibiza and then moved to the Netherlands and started her company there. I think this story is so crazy different. It's so inspiring. I love how down to earth she is, and I feel like I could talk to her for ages. So as I mentioned, she worked in the beauty space and she was climbing that corporate ladder, and she always dreamed of having her own skincare range. And with the years of experience, she never really found something that was truly unique, pure, and had natural ingredients that provided effective results until she moved to the Netherlands for love. And I think her story is so inspiring. Her husband is actually serving the royal family their tulips. So if you go to the Buckingham Palace and you see those tulips around, they are the same tulips that are in her products. I think her story is so fascinating, and I think you're going to love this episode. So without further ado, let's hear from Kim. Kim, welcome to Bougie Best Friend Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Coco. I'm so excited to be here.
Okay, we met 2019. I think that's the year that we established offline as we were chatting. It was at an event in New York City, Ipsy Beauty. But I want to start with your entire life story, because I know that you relocated your entire life once you met your husband and then you started your company. So let me just give you the stage. Tell me, where did you grow up?
So I have, that's a hard question. I'm Chinese Vietnamese by descent, and I grew up in Melbourne, born and raised. And then I actually moved to New York, and I lived in and worked in New York for about a decade. That's where I climbed the corporate ladder, worked in the beauty industry. And then I fell in love with a random stranger on the dance floor. Turns out he's a Dutch tulip farmer. And then I moved to the Netherlands for love. So I am a global citizen, I like to say.
Love it. Tell me about your days in New York. You said you were climbing the corporate ladder and you were working in the beauty space. How did that look like?
It was tough, because also given that it's so competitive in New York anyway, if you're an American and you've been at Ivy League schools and you have credentials or a graduate program from the top cosmetic companies, you know, Estee Lauder, LVMH, whomever, then even then it's really, really challenging. But for me, I went to a college that no one has ever heard of before in Melbourne. It's called Monash. Like, it's famous in Australia, but no one else in the States knows, you know, where I went to college. And I had no local US knowledge and experience. So trying to crack that first job in in beauty or cosmetics, it was really difficult. So my strategy, I actually came from pharma, and my strategy was to find a small up-and-coming company that actually had pharma brands as well as cosmetic brands, and then I could transition. And I literally sat down with the owner of the company at the time and I said, I'm accepting this brand manager role. It's 6 years, like, kind of before my resume, and I was going, you know, going backwards 6 years, but I'm going to take it, and within 6 months, I'm going to be your most senior marketing person and I'm going to be running this office. And then 6 months later,
I love this.
6 months later, I was. He gave me the smallest brand and the like kind of lowest junior, most junior title. And then within 6 months to 12 months, I was running the place. I was doing all product development, all marketing for, you know, pretty much all of the categories. And then within 24 months, I was definitely doing all the marketing, product development for all categories. So that included skincare, color cosmetics, hair care, oral care. And so that really gave me the opportunity, soup to nuts, to really understand how to build a brand in the United States. And then I moved over to corporate beauty and I ran Saint Tropez. And Saint Tropez is like a legacy brand. Wow. And a leader in its market. So I kind of did both. I did like the scrappy entrepreneurial, you know, startup brand. And then I went into like leading corporate brand. and both of those in the United States. So I think, you know, in regards to my corporate career, I really felt like I left on a high, because actually sliding doors moment when I decided to move to the Netherlands for love and walk away from my career, I actually got given a CMO role. I won't say who the makeup artist is, and I won't say the brand, but she's very famous. She's the number one makeup artist in the world, and the company's worth billions of dollars now. So I said no to that role for love, and I thought, I'm going to say goodbye to my beauty career. And now look at me.
Wow. Okay, so many questions here. Let's start with, if you can point out one skill that you developed while working in the corporate space and working in the entrepreneurial space, pretty much doing the same type of job, beauty and marketing and skincare, what would you say?
In the entrepreneurial space, this goes for the company that I run now, which is Bloom Effects, you know, launched it and I'm the founder and CEO, as well as my experience in the United States. I would say being scrappy. And even though I don't like the saying close enough is good enough, in the sense of, you know, it implies you haven't tried your best. But actually, in reality, if you're a perfectionist and you're an entrepreneur, the two don't go hand in hand. You will sweat the small stuff. You'll end up crippling yourself with anxiety, and the important things won't get done. So in a sense, close enough is good enough, because you need to get through the volume of work as an entrepreneur, and you need to be scrappy. And you need to make things work on a, you know, on a dime, basically. So I think that would be my number one learning. And then in corporate, it was really how to work key account management. I think that people don't really appreciate the power that retail has in the beauty industry. They talk about, you know, the digital unicorns. And I think over the last 12 to 24 months, people are seeing the power of retail. A lot of those digital unicorns are in physical spaces now. There's no such thing as, you know, a digital native kind of Casper or Warby Parker type brand in the beauty space. They all end up in retail. So the number one thing I learned from corporate beauty is how to work with retailers and how to speak their language and make it easier for them and walk in a straight line. Because at the end of the day, they're running a business and you're one of 1,000 brands. So you need to make sure that the squeaky wheel gets the most oil, but you also need to walk in a straight line.
I love it. Okay, we're going to get into retail conversations, because I think that's so interesting. After the pandemic, people almost like miss that feeling of going to a store and talking to somebody and feeling the products instead of just ordering online. And I feel like with skincare and beauty, it's such a personal experience. So it's almost like that's a part of the process. You go and you touch different textures and formulas and you smell everything, and it's just a different type of experience unless comparing to ordering online. So let's, I need to hear the story. You fell in love with a stranger on the dance floor. Which dance floor was it?
It was Pasha. I don't know if you know that nightclub. There was one in New York, but the OG Pasha.
There's one in Ibiza, right?
Yes, that's exactly where we met.
Okay. Okay, cool. So fun. I was just there first time ever a few months ago. I mean, in October, but okay, go ahead. I'm so interested in this.
I was on a girl's trip. He was on a guy's trip. We locked eyes on the dance floor, you know, as the story goes. But you never think you're going to marry the person you meet on a random dance floor. But I ended up doing that. Uh-huh. It turns out that he's a fourth generation Dutch tulip farmer. So we fell in love very quickly. We were essentially long distance pen pals for a while because, you know, I was working my crazy hours in New York and he's on the farm every day. And we really fell in love kind of via text and video calls. And we had probably two or three vacations together. We met in Florence, Mexico City, and then we went to Fiji. And then after then, I was just like, okay, when am I moving? Because he clearly wasn't leaving the Netherlands, because tulips come from the Netherlands. So he wasn't going to be able to be a tulip farmer in Manhattan.
I have to tell you, I bought tulips. I will show you right now. I bought tulips in preparation for this.
Oh my gosh.
I need to show you my tulips.
You're so sweet. Oh, Coco.
And I have another bouquet in my other, in another.
So on brand. I love it.
I need it. I need to be on brand when I'm speaking to you. Okay. How, since my audience loves to talk about dating and relationships, and you can just tell me, how did you guys manage to maintain that long distance relationship? Because often break long distance relationships because one person is not willing to move. Or if you can give me just one or two things that kind of held you guys together at that time.
I think honestly, I broke all the Manhattan dating rules. Like, you know, in New York, you have these rules where you don't talk about titles and you don't talk about expectations and you don't say, you don't lay it all out in the line. You like, you have a drink and then a coffee and then you go and get ice cream and then you have to count like, I don't know, 15 dates before you even say, are we exclusive? And the talk is about exclusivity, mm-hmm. not even about titles. It was draining in New York. I was completely opposite. So I thought, this is a foreigner. He doesn't have like New York standards in terms of dating rules. I'm just going to go for it. Literally the first time we talked, I'm like, I'm 34. I want kids. I want a husband. This is what I want. I'm prepared to move, but this is what I want. I want two kids before I'm 40. Like, mm-hmm. and I think that's what worked, because I was completely honest from the beginning and managed all expectations. And he's like, great, I want that, but I'm not leaving the Netherlands.
And now you have two beautiful kids and you're living in the Netherlands and you're running a hugely successful business. And that's, I mean, the dream.
Thank you. And I did end up having the two just before I was 40. So Fleur, my second, she was born when I was 39 and I turned 40 like 5 months after, 6 months after.
Do you manifest and you believe in like vision boards and stuff like that?
I manifest. I don't have a physical vision board, but I do have a very specific vision board in my, like in my head, a mental one. And I did always picture myself having two girls specifically before I was 40. And I didn't know, I didn't manifest the Netherlands or Amsterdam mm-hmm. or Europe. I didn't know who he was going to be and what my life would look like. But I could always see my daughters, which is really strange.
I love it. Okay, let's talk about your move to the Netherlands. So you were living in New York for how long when you decided to make the move?
It was less than 6 months that we met and then I decided to move. And the move took longer than, you know, all the visa and everything like that. So yeah. We met in August and I was here for tulip season. I was here in April.
My birthday is in April. That's another sign. I don't know for what, but I love it. Yeah.
You're so on brand.
So on brand. How long were you living in New York before you moved to the Netherlands? Because I'm interested in the culture shock.
Almost 8 years. Yeah. Almost mm-hmm. 8 years in New York and Australia and New York. That was seamless. Like I feel like mm-hmm. Aussies, I don't know if you have Australian friends, but Aussies kind of just really assimilate to especially New York life. The hustle, the bustle it's a bigger city, but culturally pretty similar. So mm-hmm. I didn't have any culture shock going to New York. And then coming to the Netherlands, it was a huge culture shock. And I think it still is. Like, I don't really mm-hmm. think I've integrated, to be honest. And it's something that I need to work on.
What do you think is the biggest difference when it comes to lifestyle?
Oh my gosh, everything. I dream big. And mm-hmm. I always wanted to start my own business. And when Bloom Effects was just an idea and a PowerPoint, and I didn't even have lab samples. I feel like a lot of my friends in the States were like, oh, this is going to be a startup. This is what you're going to do. Like we need to connect you with this person in tech. Have you spoken to this person? They're a trader. They can give you advice. You know, it was all like hustle, hustle, hustle. And how big can you make it? And I think that's very much the American dream. But in Europe, it's like, just be normal, like get a 9-to-5 job. You know, why are you making your life so hard? You're planning to have babies. It was just very, very different. A lot of people work part-time here as well, so they can't understand why I didn't take maternity leave both times, that like I was on conference calls in labor. Those things are not mm-hmm. normal, but I needed to do them because I'm working in a startup and the founder. But certainly not Dutch culture. And then I think the other thing that was a huge shock is, do you ever go Dutch on a check? You know how people say, let's go Dutch on a uh-huh. check, you know, at a restaurant?
The biggest conversation on my podcast. That's how they do it. They always go Dutch.
They call it going Dutch for a reason, because Dutch people wow. invented it. And they'll send you a Venmo for like, you know, $1.26.
Wow. I didn't even recognize the Dutch, that's what, why they call it Dutch. That's insane. So how long have you been in the Netherlands now?
I want to say 5 years. And mm-hmm. I don't speak a lick of Dutch, unfortunately. I understand four-year-olds Dutch, but I would say daughter speaks better Dutch.
It's very difficult. Dutch than I do. I feel like it's such a tough difficult language. Let's talk
but
about...
But what I love about the Netherlands is the tulips, the healthy, like the healthy atmosphere here. They're the tallest people in the world. They're the happiest kids in the world. There are a lot of things that are from a social perspective, like their social system and their safety net is really good. And a lot of the things that I appreciate as an Australian, I think are good here, like free education, free healthcare, etc.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is in Croatia. I feel like I had everything free growing up. I had good grades, so I went to college for free. And here, it's just insane. Just such a big difference. And when you were saying how here in the Netherlands, people don't understand the hustle and bustle, that's the same thing in my home country. People were always telling me, why do you need to work? Like, why are you working so hard? Just relax, just take it easy. You don't have to prove anything. But I think you just have that fire in you your entire life. So you said that you always wanted to have your own brand. So I want to know from the very beginning, when you even first came up with the idea, how was that entire process for you?
It really comes down to one moment. And I know that this sounds cliche, but I was arranging a vase of tulips. We'd hand cut them from the fields. Like I said, I just moved here from New York. I moved in time for tulip season because it was a bucket list. I wanted to see the tulip fields. I wanted to be that Instagram girl that is running and frolicking through the fields. So we hand cut some tulips. By the way, you can't do that unless you know the farmer, because obviously it's private property. Mm, yeah. But I knew the farmer. I knew the farmer. So we hand cut. I hand cut some of his produce, and then I put it in a vase. And as I'm arranging them, I said, "Hein, no offense, I really do love tulips, but they're kind of annoying. They flop over in a vase. What do I do?" Like, I thought he was going to give me a tip of a shot of vodka. Is it, put a penny in the water, cut them on a certain angle. You've heard all of the tips and hacks of how to get your tulip standing up straight, right? And he was quite defensive, obviously, because he's a tulip farmer. And what he said was, "Kim, that's the beauty of a tulip. They're one of the only flowers that continue to grow after they're cut." And I was like, "Huh, so they're regenerating on their own." And he's like, "I guess you can call it that." So then obviously my beauty brain was going off, and I was like, from a marketing perspective, what a beautiful story. What a simple message. Everyone taking something that every single person on earth knows what a tulip is, and everyone has had that same experience of tulips flopping over in a vase. If I can somehow capture that in a bottle, work out what compounds create that, and if they're good for the skin, we have something magical. We have something that's breakthrough. And not only that, it's waste, because I know I called my husband a tulip farmer, but actually he's a bulb grower, so he doesn't use anything above the soil. That's all waste or byproduct. He's digging up the bulbs and selling the bulbs. So we're starting from a upcycled, a waste, a byproduct, and then upcycling that for something great that delivers fantastic results to the skin. I'm like, this is too good to be true. Surely someone's done this. Quick Google search. No one's ever used tulips in skincare. I'm like, okay, so we would be the first. And I'm getting so excited. I'm like, how do I start this though, Hein? Like, I have no capital behind me. How do we find out what's in a tulip? And he's like, surely there's government grants, Kim. Like, all I can do is, I'll look at government grants in terms of circularity, because we're starting off with a tulip farmer and we're using a waste or byproduct. We can then get government grants. I'll find something. So of course he was right. We got two government grants actually, and they were based on the notion of circularity within the tulip industry. And the tulip industry is obviously so important to the Dutch economy. So we got the government grants, and we were supported by the University of Leiden. And that's where we identified the compounds: auxin, kenitin, and flavonoids. They're the three main compounds that are rich in a tulip, and they've already been documented in skincare. So this is not a new compound. This is an existing compound that's already used in skincare, but this is a new and rich source. And auxin and kenitin are both responsible for that growth, that elongation that I was talking about in the tulip, and they provide strength for the skin barrier, amino acids. They also balance the skin. And then flavonoids are a rich form of antioxidant. Drinking red wine, eating dark chocolate, they're rich in flavonoids. So it makes sense. The more pigmented the flower, the higher the flavonoid count. And tulips, if you ask anyone about tulips, what do they love? It's the color.
Wow. This is amazing how you just came up with an entire brand as you were cutting tulips. I mean, this is brilliant. So you did all of your research, you got the grant, and then how did you start with actually building a brand? Because as you said, you were on your own completely. Is he helping you? Like, tell me a little bit about that beginning when you were like, okay, I have this idea, now let's make it into reality.
Well, this was circa 2018 when it was an idea, when it was a PowerPoint. We did all the research and I bootstrapped 2018 and 2019 and then realized that if we were going to make this a big brand, I needed to go to the United States and, you know, become a C Corp, raise money, get investors, and then at the same time, get physical distribution. Coming from the beauty industry, I've always believed in true omnichannel. I didn't believe in digital natives. And we talked about that just before about how even digital natives have all gone into retail. And so for me, I was like, I need to secure a strong retail partner out the gate. And we were so lucky. We got Saks, Bloomingdale's, Blue Mercury, Credo on air on QVC, like within the first 3 months. I think no indie brand has done that. We launched end of November 2019. So we were in retail within the first quarter of 2020. And you know what happened in March of 2020, right?
Of course.
All this inventory in stores we'd raised and then the doors closed. And I couldn't get back in the country until I think it was middle of November 2021.
You were stuck in the Netherlands or Europe. In the US? Okay. Wow.
I was stuck in Europe. Luckily, I didn't get on a flight because I remember Trump said, we're closing the borders to Europe. It's going to happen 6 p.m. Friday night. And it was March 2020. And I was calling the QVC buyer because I had an on-air show on that Saturday. And I was like, there's still flights available. Maybe I just like, you know, I'll land at 6:45. Surely they won't close the border at 6:45. I'll only be 45 minutes late. And then I'll come home. And then they were like, we don't know what's happening. We don't know how serious this is. We don't have a procedure. We don't have a policy. Maybe you can Skype in. And I was like, oh, if you're willing to Skype, I'll do that. This was the first time that QVC had even considered Skyping. Turns out now, like, I was the very, very first Skype QVC guest ever on record. And they've been doing Skype ever since. And luckily, I didn't sneak in because I wouldn't have been able to come home because that the border stayed closed from until November. So it was almost 2 years, November 2021.
As you were retelling this, like, COVID story, I got flashbacks. It was so traumatic at that time because I was working in beauty. I was a full-on makeup artist. And I remember I had a March 17, I had a photo shoot for Bloomingdale's that got canceled because of COVID. So like, I remember that entire week so vividly. It was crazy. I'm so glad that you were able to come back. I mean, stay home. So you were like not stuck in the US. That would be horrible. But let's talk about the retail aspect. How were you able to get into retail that fast? Because I feel like a lot of young entrepreneurs, indie brands, that's their dream. They want to get into a retailer and they don't really know how much it takes to get there and actually stay relevant in the retail space. So if you can expand more on the retail, how to get in there. If you don't know anybody, I'm sure that you probably had an idea how to get there since you were in the beauty space for that long. But if you can tell us a little bit about getting into dream retailers.
I think the main thing is having those relationships, keeping those relationships alive. I was then able to hit my Rolodex again. And of course, all of my work, my effort, my, you know, accolades, everything that I'd achieved in corporate kept us, you know, connected in terms of us and the buyers. And then when I was presenting our product, I was like, this is my own baby. This is my, like, my personal story. They were also curious, like, Kim, it's been a couple of years. What are you doing with, you know? And I'm like, oh, I met a Dutch guy. I moved to the Netherlands. So it was semi catch up, but also, look here, I've got, you know, a product in a jar to show you in a PowerPoint presentation. So even before we went into official, like, manufacturing, we'd secured 3-4 top retailers, which was pretty incredible.
Wow. Okay. Tell me about the brand. The branding is beautiful. It feels so luxurious, and the textures and everything is just so high end. So how did you first decide to go that route versus having it like, you know, your typical everyday, I don't want to call it cheap moisturizers, but you know what I mean? How did you decide to go that route, and how did you go about the branding?
For me, it was very organic. I think being a founder, you get the privilege to choose what you like. And I'm in my 40s, so I'm not Gen Z, and I'm not attracted to fluorescent colors. I have full appreciation for brands that are fluorescent colors. And what is it, Gen Alpha now? They're going after, you know, very poppy brands, and they're yeah. destroying Sephora. You've seen it all over TikTok.
I've seen it. Shocking.
For me, I'm in my 40s and I don't try to be cool. So I guess our brand doesn't try to be cool. We want to be classic. We want to be efficacious. We want to mean something to someone, whether it's a gift for yourself, because, you know, self-care is so important, or a gift for someone that you love. You want a beautiful unboxing experience that is elevated and elegant and timeless. So going for timeless generally means that you go for more, you know, traditional lines, you know, even architecture, in design, in anything aesthetic, it brings you back to more traditional formats, but you can do that in a modern way. So we have really modern textures, and I didn't compromise on the textures. Just because our branding looks more heritage doesn't mean that the formulas are heritage, because I'm inspired by K-beauty. I'm Asian myself. I've worked in the industry for decades. I know all the best manufacturers and chemists in the world. And so I had the ability to go speed to market in terms of creating our proprietary Dutch tulip complex, and then going to the best formulators in the world who make all of the best luxurious brands. And you'd be surprised, there's only like a handful of laboratories actually that make the best of the best. And I was able to produce incredible textures, incredible formulas. And I think our secret sauce is, again, lazy mum here. I am very simple in my routines. So I always wanted products that were multitaskers, like they do more than one thing, because I don't have any time and I'm sleep deprived and I'm busy. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm also lazy as well. I just don't have the passion and enthusiasm with my own face to stand in front of the mirror for a very long time and do multiple steps. I'm a bit ADHD when it comes to that. So I need to like get it done quickly and just move on. And so all of our products, mm-hmm. yes, they look very luxurious and they look very elegant, but they're really efficacious. We use clinical grade ingredients at the raw material clinical grade, which is very important, because these days they can say all of the keywords, glycolic acid, you know, glycerin, et cetera, et cetera. But what percentages are they actually using? Maybe it's fairy dust and the rest of it's filler. We actually use clinical ingredients mm-hmm. at clinical grade. Plus we have our tulip complex, and plus we have really fun textures, because again, I've come from beauty, I've worked in retail, and I know you need demonstrability. And you've worked in beauty as well. Like, part of having the client experience is that sensorial like experience. Mm-hmm. They want to feel pampered, even if it's just 15 minutes. And that comes from texture. Texture doesn't necessarily mean that mm-hmm. it's going to do better, or it's going to last, or it's going to fix your wrinkles. It's about sensorial, but it's very important where you're stopping a client, you know, and they're trying to buy, you know, the cream that they've bought for 20 years. If you want to say, try this, it's the texture and the packaging that stops them. Then it's the story. And then they have to believe that it works. So then you hit them with the clinicals and the before and afters and the consumer perception studies.
Wow. I told you offline that I'm obsessed with multiple products of yours, but my favorite is the SPF. And sometimes it's almost like it's tinted, but it's not tinted in a way that it doesn't fit your skin. And you know, different skin tones can use it. So how do you come up with these innovative products, and also the dewiness after? Sometimes I just apply that and I put some concealer and that's my skin for the day. So how do you come up with all of your products? I mean, I'm sure that you, as with your experience, you kind of, I don't want to assume, but you can kind of see what's going to be trending and what's going to attract the audience. But at the same time, I'm sure from concept to market, there's a long it's a long win. So as you were saying, things go viral, Gen Z goes this and that, and maybe you're creating a product. And how are you sure that in a year or so, when the product is actually finished, that it's still going to be relevant? If you can speak a little bit on that.
Yeah, I think virality is very important. And obviously the sensorial textures, new categories, that's really important. But if I go back to kind of fashion analogies, like a little black dress is never going out of fashion. You need a little black dress. You need, you know, a white shirt. You need a blazer. You need a nice belt. You need a pair of loafers. You need a pair of pointy heels. Like, these are just things that are classic and never will go out of fashion. And in skincare, it's the same. You need a moisturizer. You need an SPF. You need a vitamin C. You need something to wash your face with. And then at night, you need a retinol. And then the rest of it is just like, you know, the icing, the frosting on the top. And so for me, it was like building a regimen that had the bare bones of the little black dress and the white shirt and the blazer, but delivering it in a different way. And I think that having products, again, that are multitask like friendly, that can be used not just a moisturizer, but a mask, or a product that you can use as a slugging alternative, like our Nectar, which is my absolute favorite product. Mm-hmm. It's a moisturizer, but it's so much more than a moisturizer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think this is the product that I showed you when we very first like had the very first meeting.
Yes.
And it's so unique, right? It looks like honey.
No, it's beautiful. And it's the experience of using your products versus another brand, it's just the sensorial, the taste, not the taste, the smell, everything is just, you're enjoying it. And I personally love when my products have a scent. I'm not like one of those that I just, want to have the ingredient. I just want to have a nice experience while I'm applying the product. And something, I don't know if I told you this when we were chatting before, I remember vividly at the Ipsy event, you were the only brand that gave me that nice bag. What kind of bag was that? I don't know.
It's like the a tote jute bag material. Oh my gosh. I have one here.
Yes.
Like this one.
Yes. I didn't know the name of the material. Yes. This jute material. I remember, I was like, wow, this brand is, I swear to God, that's what I remember from when I met you. And then I put all of my, you know how everybody gives you a sample in that small little like rinky-dink bag? So I put all of those small samples in your bag. And this is branding 101. Like, give me a nicer bag and I'll just, I'll just show your product instead of all these other ones. So that's something that I remember since 2019. And I had to share. So for somebody who might be starting a brand today, how would you suggest they... Because there's so many brands today. Everybody, everybody's trying to speak to a different type of audience. Some people are Gen Z vibes. Some people are going for the more mature. How would you separate yourself in the beauty space? There's so much noise, as we know.
It's really challenging. There is so much competition out there and it's crippling. And I think that if you keep on looking at competitors, you'll never get started. If you truly passionately want to do something in any industry, I think everything's saturated. Consumer goods is just saturated entirely. And there's no such thing as a new idea these days. There's a new way of telling the story. So I think that if you're telling a new story and you're meeting a need that hasn't been met before, even if it's your own personal need, I think that's a really good start. But don't cripple yourself with competitive analysis or like the business plan and trying to make everything perfect. Like I said before, close enough is good enough. Just get started and you'll learn on the go. I've made incredibly terrible mistakes, but you dust yourself off. Tomorrow's a new day. Be kind to yourself and learn. Continuous improvement is the most important thing. So as long as you learn from those mistakes and, it's not going to break anything. There are some terrible decisions you can make that's really going to break a company. But overall, most of them are small and you can really dust yourself off and learn from it and improve. And I think that with anxiety these days and people, concerned about mental health, etc., if you stress over the small stuff, it can cripple people. And I know it has crippled people before. So don't sweat the small stuff. Like, life's too short. Just go out, try. And what's the worst that can happen? you fail. A lot of entrepreneurs fail. Most entrepreneurs fail. And like most serial entrepreneurs fail. Like they have three or four different businesses before they hit the big time. So if you have that mentality and you think, okay, well, this is my own Harvard Business School experience, then you can look at it at a totally different lens, right?
And I think when it comes to mistakes, sometimes other people don't even notice the mistake. It's just you that are so obsessed with every single detail and you want to get it perfect because, yes, it is your baby and you want to show it in the best possible light. But if you can remember one mistake that you can share that was, at the moment, the worst thing that happened to you in your life, and how did you handle it? And how did you kind of, if you can just give me some kind of example.
Yeah, I think the dew cream is probably one of the biggest personal mistakes of mine. We rushed to market. It had been COVID and we hadn't had much newness. We launched the dew drops, which was incredibly successful. So I wanted to then go, okay, how do we like anniversarize that success? The problem with success is that you have to then do it again in 12 months time, right? So how do I anniversarize this? I thought, okay, dew drops is a serum, I'll do dew cream. And I wasn't, you know, I just had a baby. I wasn't traveling as much. I wasn't there holding the hand of the manufacturer, and I wasn't there for the first production run. I had, you know, video calls, etc. And then I proved on site with video, the texture was wrong. And then within a month, we realized it wasn't, it was separating. It was supposed to be a beautiful panna cotta texture and it was going liquidy. And we were really honest about it. You know, I called up the retailer and I said, I've got it wrong. This is not right. This is not what I promised. I pushed back on my laboratory partners. They were really actually supportive because I'm like, this is what I approved. This is my lab sample in the lab packaging. This is what went out to market. The two don't match. Like, this is not what I intended. One was like soup and the other one was like panna cotta, very different textures. And they said something went wrong in the manufacturing. And as much as you can plan for everything to be perfect, even like in a factory, things can go wrong with hundreds of people working on it. So all you can do is own it, apologize. We apologize to our audience, to our consumers, to our customers. We limited the batch. We didn't launch it in the rest of the retail partners. As soon as I found out, we limited the risk, I guess you could say. And then I worked on reformulating. I'm like, what's went wrong? Why did it go soupy? We need to thicken it up. How can we work on it? And then when we relaunched the product, it was launching at the same time as that Lewis Thrower On song, that Jiggle Jiggle song that went viral. Do you remember? And it was like on TikTok and Instagram. So it was perfect because I wanted the whole time, even before that song even existed, I wanted a jiggly texture. I wanted it to look like panna cotta. I wanted it to look like old school Jello that when you move the plate, it jiggled. And we got there.
Yeah. It's almost like a blessing in disguise. I mean, with that song, I'm sure that it was so much fun to create content and just the branding around it. It was so much fun. I mean, everything happens for a reason. And as you said, like you have to own it and kind of try to go from there. But I'm sure it was not easy to have all those conversations with all those retailers. So tell me, if somebody does have to have a hard conversation with somebody, maybe even their employees, do you have any tips how to deliver the news?
I've been told that I'm very direct, and maybe I've learned that more so being Dutch, because the Dutch are super direct. I think the best way that you can deliver bad news is show empathy and also literally say, this is not an easy conversation to have. I always start off by saying that I'm really uncomfortable with having this conversation, but we need to have this conversation for these reasons. I think then people get into a mindset that they're prepared for bad news. You know, it's very hard to go from how's the weather, how's your mom, and then softly trying to, what I call delivering a shit sandwich, you know, like bread, shit, bread. Like people try to do that. It doesn't work. You know what's in between. You can't hide the, you know, whatever it is between the two slices of bread. No, you need to manage expectations. And that's the line that I use, this is, you know, I have some bad news. This is a very difficult conversation to have, and then go into it, because then it also sets the tone and it shows empathy. It shows that you're a real person and like, it's not comfortable.
All right. This is a amazing, beautiful advice. So thank you for that. I have so many questions for you, but I'm going to try to do just a few more. When you started the brand, were you the only one? And then you started building your team slowly. If you can tell me a little bit about building your team and who was the first person that you hired. And also sometimes you know that you can do most things yourself, but you have to delegate in order to make other things grow and to put your time elsewhere. So how did you start hiring and realize who is the right person for the job?
I'm going to be honest. I was not a good hirer in the beginning or building out a team. I made the mistake of leaning on relationships. It worked so well with my customers, right? But you don't have to work with your customers on a daily basis. Your customers, you know, you're there to service your customers. So it worked leveraging those relationships. I did that internally as well. And sometimes running your own business and having close friends work in your team isn't the secret sauce. I know some people, it works really well for them. And unfortunately for me, maybe it was the distance, the time zones, the fact that I was going to motherhood, and the stress of that. Perhaps it was because I worked in corporate and I was a different, I've done a lot of reflecting and I was a different person in corporate. Maybe you care so much more when it's your own business, and maybe I was a different person. I'm not sure what exactly the answer is, but I think that I made a lot of recruitment mistakes in terms of fit because of not being able to have the people in one place, in one location. And I don't want to blame technology, but working from home and recruiting over a laptop, even if you know the people and you've known them and they're, you know, friendly or ex-coworkers or whatever, it's just not the same. And then not having a physical office to go to every day and build a new culture. You're relying on the old culture. You're relying on what you used to be or when you used to both live in New York, etc. Things change. People move on. And not having that center of gravity was very difficult to recruit. So what I've done now is really to build a team that wants to work at Bloom Effects. And I truly believe in personal grit. And so I stopped looking at people's resumes, to be honest. And I didn't look at like accolades or what they've achieved or, you know, what companies they've worked at, because it turned out all the cookie cutter people weren't necessarily right for the entrepreneurial startup lifestyle and weren't right for the fact that we work on four different time zones. So we have people in Australia. We have, because I'm Aussie, we and my dad and my brother still work in the business and they help me. My brother's my Excel spreadsheet guy and my dad is my numbers guy and my ops guy. And I, you know, work in Europe and then we have East Coast and then we have West Coast. So I don't sleep and I work, you know, round the clock and I take breaks when I can. I take naps when I can. I shower when I can in between calls and different time zones. And it's not a life for everybody. It's just the way we've organically built because of COVID, and we never really recovered from COVID in terms of having a center point of gravity, because our customers and consumers and our business is American and the founder and the tulips live in the Netherlands, and I can never change that because this is where the tulips are from and we're a tulip brand. Like it's literally the root of our business. So we're always going to have a sea between the customers and, you know, the raw material. Yeah, so I've had to really learn how to build a team around that, and it's extremely unique. And I'm pleased to say that I love our team. They're like family. Some of them are actually family, and I've really had to focus on people that are self-starters, self-motivated, and I would say grit is the number one red thread that they all have. Some of them didn't come from the industry, some did, and most of them didn't have the L'Oreal, Estee Lauder, you know, Coty, Shiseido. Not that there's anything wrong with those big companies, but for us personally, like in our team, no one's come from those backgrounds, except my dad. mm-hmm. not those companies, but he's worked for really big beauty companies. So I would say the only cookie cutter person on paper in terms of beauty resume is ironically my father and me. And me.
Wow. I just think your story is so fascinating, and I just think I can like listen to you speak for so long because you're such a wealth of knowledge when it comes to all things business and building a brand, and you have this background and that background, and now you have this business of your own. So I really wanted to thank you for coming on here today and sharing amazing tips, and just I love your brand truly, and I only have people on my podcast that I truly want to hear from. So I'm so happy you came on, and I would love for you to tell everybody where they can find you, where they can find the products.
Yes, of course. Check out our website, bloomeffects.com, and also trusted retailers like Bluemercury, Credo, QVC.com, Saks, Bloomingdale's, if you're in the United Kingdom, Harrods, and Sephora. And if you don't know where to find us, just follow us on Bloomeffects, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and you can DM us and we'll point you in the right direction.
Would you be open to doing a little giveaway for my audience?
Yes, Coco, let's do it. What do we do? Where do I sign up?
Okay, they have to head over to Bougie Best Friend Instagram, where I'm going to post a little clip from our conversation. They have to tell us what was their favorite part of the conversation, and obviously follow Bloomeffects on Instagram, and then we're going to notify the lucky winner through my Bougie Best Friend page. I think that's amazing. So much fun.
The lucky listener will be able to win a $150 gift card.
Okay, perfect. Love that. So make sure to leave a comment on my page and follow Bloomeffects, and you might just win a really lovely gift card. So thank you for that.
Of course. Love it. Okay, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Coco.
This was wonderful. Thanks again. And I'll make sure to check all of everything. Like, I'm going to probably do so much more research on you right now because I'm just so fascinated. So thanks again.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Bougie Bestie, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe to my podcast so you never miss out. I release new episodes every Friday. If you love Bougie Best Friend, please leave a 5-star rating and a review. Your support means the world and it helps the show grow. You can also follow me on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Coco Beauty, and you can find Bougie Best Friend on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcasting platforms. Love you, bye.